This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today, legislation would allow private sector police all the authority and protections as city, county, and state police officers. Police chiefs don't like it.
We do not need private policing, mercenary police officers. We don't need that type of policing here in Michigan.
Michigan Radio reporter Sarah Swick looks deeper into the Macomb County Jail.
A lot of people are in the Macomb County Jail for basically misdemeanor offenses and some fairly minor crimes.
We hear what an expert thinks of President Trump's statements on climate change.
If you were sitting on a public bus and the guy next to you was muttering that climate change was a hoax manufactured by the Chinese, you'd probably get up and find another seat.
Plus, a cocktail made with whiskey from Ann Arbor. All that and more coming up. But first, here's a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later this hour, we talk with our political commentators about tax incentives for big corporations and developments.
Every state has to have these in order to attract these big, big job producers of thousands of jobs.
But first, what do you think of more private police forces in Michigan? Do you think your city police department should be able to contract with private firms for police officers with all the authority and all the protections given to a public police officer? The Republican majority leader in the Senate, Arlen Meekoff, has introduced legislation that would do that, and he says he's determined to see it passed. Joining me is Bill Stevenson. He's the executive director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. What do you think of allowing any corporation, private college, or others having their own private police force?
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Lester. We really appreciate that. The Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police has taken a position against that, and there's a multitude of reasons why we think this is a very bad idea for cities, for colleges, and most importantly, for public safety and the citizens in the state of Michigan.
Well, let's talk about some of those reasons. He suggested police departments could supplement their own forces by contracting with police firms. That might be handy for a police chief. Why would you be against that?
Well, the best police are local police, and we wouldn't want a private police to start taking the place of public police. One of the reasons for that is, and I'm going to do a little bit of a history lesson. If we go back about 40 or 50 years when we were having the riots and such back in the 60s, a report came out called Challenge of Crime in a Free Society. And one of the things that came out of that was that the police need to be more responsible to their community, and it started community policing. And then we go forward, and we've had some problems in the recent past, again, between the police and the public, and then came President Obama's 21st century policing report. And they brought together the best minds there were in the country to look at the criminal justice system, and it came out with six pillars. And again, it reiterates the police being accountable to the public, transparency, relationships. Nowhere does it say that the police should be a private for-profit company that comes in from out of state to do policing in neighborhoods. You know, the American policing style is based off of England, you know, Sir Robert Peel. And one of the things which they talked about there is that the police are the public, or he said, the police are the public and the public are the police. He would roll over today to think that Michigan is contemplating changing to a system that the police are an out-of-state, for-profit policing company that are not accountable to the public.
Municipal police forces require some training. How would you be able to ensure a private police force has trained officers if you're just signing a contract with someone?
Well, and that specifically talks about some of the features that are lacking in this bill. The requirements that this bill has for policing and police chief are standards that, quite frankly, are back in the 50s, and they're appalling. The only thing that a person would have to have is 3 years police experience or 4 years police experience, and you could be running a police agency. You just can't have been convicted of a felony within the last 5 years, and you could be running a police agency. The requirements are much less than most police departments have, and there's a multitude of problems there. Another issue that this bill has is that there is no background check required for a police officer within a 2-year period they were employed at a police department. So what you would have is the likelihood or the possibility that a police officer had been in trouble at their department, had resigned in lieu of termination or been terminated, and if it's within that two-year window, one of these private police agencies could hire that officer, and they wouldn't even be required to do a background check.
I'm wondering if contracting a private police force were cheaper for a municipality, how do you think the taxpayers would respond to the idea?
I think the taxpayers would respond to this, that they would not be in favor of lessening the professionalism of their police department. I think that the public understands that there are some things you have to pay for, and professional police officers are one of those. And that's evidenced by police millages overwhelmingly pass. The public consistently says they will invest in their police department because that's their public safety. That's their livelihood. That's their property. That's their family's lives. So I don't think in this particular case the public would have much appetite to turn over their policing and their security to an out-of-state for-profit company to come in to police them.
Now, the other part of this is, you know, establishing private police forces. As the Detroit News reported, there are private police forces now, 14 of them in the state, including GM, Henry Ford Health System, and others. So why allow some when maybe a private college or a charter school or a business with highly sensitive materials or information might feel their need for a police force is just as valid?
Well, they can already do that, Lester, and as you said, but the difference is who are they responsible to? And they are responsible, like the colleges. There's regions that oversee that. For hospitals, there are board of directors that oversee them. So when you have a problem, you have people that are accountable, people that you can go to, people that you can demand change from. Who are you going to demand change from when you have a problem with a police agency that's under contract, whose offices are in North Carolina?
So if you had a chance to sit down with Arlen Meekhoff, what would you tell him directly?
I would tell the senator that what we have now is fine. We do not need private policing, mercenary police officers. We don't need that type of policing here in Michigan. We do not need former military coming in without being certified as police officers using the Blackwater policing style. You know, that's a fine company in Iraq, but not in Michigan.
Bob Stevenson is the executive director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. He spent 37 years in the Livonia Police Force, the last seven as chief. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it.
We asked Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff to speak with us about this issue, and his office declined.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Tomorrow, Ann Arbor Distilling will be releasing its second batch of bourbon and rye. The Cheers team, which is made up of Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings and me, got a chance to sample both whiskeys ahead of the release. Here's Tammy talking to the product developer and brand ambassador at Ann Arbor Distilling, Phil Attee, about the newly branded Fox River whiskeys.
So what can you tell us about them?
So these batches are both still very small. We were releasing about 700 bottles of rye and about 1,200 bottles of bourbon. So even though they've been aging a little bit longer, they're still very small batches. The bourbon is a rye bourbon. It's a high rye bourbon, actually. So that's 71% corn, 25% rye, and then 4% malted barley. It's bottled at 102.5 proof. We found that a little bit higher than that was too hot, and a little bit lower than that was sort of flabby and the flavors didn't come through quite as well.
I was really impressed, actually. I tasted the bourbon, and I didn't know what the proof was when I tasted it. I was like, oh, this is delicious. And then later I found that out. I was like, no way. It drinks really smooth for a bourbon of that proof.
On purpose. The bourbon itself was aged for 2 years in the charred American oak barrels, and then it was finished for 4 months in some French oak. And so it was distilled specifically and managed to be aged for that period of time. Just like the last one was only meant to be aged for 8 months, this one was only meant to be aged for about 2 years.
I'm sure you'll be completely surprised that later I asked Tammy to mix a cocktail to complement the bourbon. She mixed one up, and I asked her why that cocktail.
Well, I thought about instantly one of my favorite fall cocktails, which I call the Autumnal. And I love it because it's really flexible. You can use any spirit you like. But my favorite to use in it is bourbon. And I thought this bourbon would be a really good fit. I also love it because it has cider in it. And we are deep in cider season right now. So I thought it'd be a really good seasonal way to use this brand new product that's come out in this season.
Okay, how do you make the Autumnal?
So it's 1.5 ounces of whatever whiskey you like. I like to use bourbon, but you can use rye. You can even use an aged rum if that's the kind of spirit you prefer. And then I like 1/2 ounce of Benedictine, which is a French herbal liqueur. It's sweet, kind of got some honey notes. Goes really nicely with bourbon and goes really nice with apple cider, which we're going to add 2 ounces of, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, and just a couple dashes of, I used a Blackstrap bitters from Bitter Cube in Wisconsin, but you could use Angostura bitters or whatever.
I noticed you garnished this with a flaming orange peel, and I'm always fascinated when that happens because it's a nice little show, but how do you do that?
Right. So the trick is when you squeeze an orange peel, right, you're expressing those orange oils that are in the surface of the peel. And if you do that over a match or a lighter, then you can ignite those oils as they pass across the flame. And yes, in a dim bar with the lights down, looks really impressive. And it also caramelizes the orange oils and does have a slight difference in the flavor.
Does it really? Because that's, you know, it's a good show, but I don't think I ever really pick up caramel orange taste.
We'll have to do a side-by-side comparison sometimes, Lester, and see if you can tell the difference.
Where would somebody go to find out how to do that?
There's lots of videos on YouTube, and we can include a link in the story about this on Michigan Radio.
All right, well, I'll take a taste of the Autumnal. Wow, you could sip a lot of that at a time.
It is a nice light drink in terms of its flavor profile. It's not a spirit-heavy, stirred drink like a Manhattan or an
old-fashioned.
Right,
no, cider's up front. Yeah.
Right, the cider's really up front, and it's meant to just be a nice thing to have with dinner. And as I said before, really versatile. So if you don't have Benedictine and you have another liqueur you like a ginger liqueur would go really nicely in here. It's very much a recipe that you can adapt to your own tastes and just take advantage of the great local cider that we have in season right now and our great local Michigan whiskeys.
Well, thanks for making the Autumnal.
Cheers.
From organic farming to genetically modified crops, Americans are confused about food. A new effort at Michigan State is trying to change that. We'll hear more about that in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Yesterday on Stateside, we heard the story of Jennifer Myers. She was the 37-year-old woman who died of sepsis at the Macomb County Jail in 2013. That jail has been dealing with chronic overcrowding problems for a lot of years now. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is here to tell us more about the role the county's courts play in that situation. So why is the jail so overcrowded?
Hi, Lester. Well, it's been overcrowded, or they've had a pretty chronic overcrowding situation for actually about the past 15 years or so. Lately, the opioid epidemic and heroin has had a huge impact on the population of the jail. A lot of people showing up there detoxing with serious addiction issues. Also, like in county jails all over the country as well, mental health issues, a lot of mentally ill people winding up in jail as well. But looking into the numbers, a lot of people are in Macomb County Jail for basically misdemeanor offenses and some fairly minor crimes, so that contributes to the overcrowding.
So back to Jennifer Myers for a second. Was this what they call a pay or stay situation?
Yeah, it was. So a little bit more about Jennifer Myers and her background. She was a 37-year-old mother of 3 children. She was addicted to heroin. And she had been in jail a number of times, actually 16 times since 2008 until the time she died there in 2013. This was for a range of offenses, everything from traffic infractions and unpaid child support, which was actually the last thing she was incarcerated for, to some drug charges and also retail fraud. She basically could have walked out of jail if she had been able to pay $500 toward the delinquent child support that she owed, but she couldn't pay it, and so she went to jail. And this is actually a pretty common situation all over the country, again, but especially with people who are addicts or who are simply poor. A lot of times they start out in the system, get in for a couple of minor offenses, misdemeanors, and fines and fees pile up, and then they start cycling through the court system over and over again, and a lot of that time they end up in jail.
So this is what they call it pay or stay. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, it's actually not supposed to happen for the most part. There are some limited circumstances I'll talk about in a minute. But per se sentencing, the U.S. Supreme Court actually ruled it to be unconstitutional, to be the modern day equivalent of a debtor's prison in the 1970s. But that was never really strictly enforced. A lot of judges continued doing it anyway. This is Michael Steinberg. He's with the Michigan ACLU. And they actually pushed recently for a new court rule here in Michigan to put some pretty strict limits on per se sentencing.
It's unconstitutional unless the court inquires into a defendant's ability to pay and finds that the defendant has the ability to pay and refuses to pay.
So basically, you can't just send somebody to jail if they could otherwise pay to get out. You're sending them to jail because they're poor, and you shouldn't do that. Steinberg says the ACLU had been pushing for this new court rule restricting payer stay for years now. He said the practice seemed to spike in Michigan, especially pretty recently, around 2009, when the Great Recession really hit. But it didn't really seem to get much traction until there was another high-profile death in the Macomb County Jail. It was David Stachewski. He actually died there in 2014, but it hit the news in 2015. And there was actual video footage of him dying, a pretty horrifying-looking death.
I remember that, yeah.
From drug withdrawal from prescribed medications that he didn't receive while he was in jail.
This was a shocking death, and the fact that he was in there for an unconstitutional sentence really caught the attention of the court.
And so the Michigan Supreme Court did act, and there is a new court rule now, and that took effect in 2016.
Well, I guess the question is, are the courts now complying with the rule?
Well, I can't speak for the courts as a whole, obviously, or even all Macomb County courts, but I did spend some time in the 39th District Court in Roseville. That's just outside Detroit. That's the same court that sentenced David Stachewski to 30 days in jail for what amounted to fines over unpaid traffic tickets, and I heard a lot of this.
$300 or 30 days, Macomb County Jail, $125 crime victim rights fee, plus a $100 benchmark fee, and then count two is 175, 700 total, or 30 days, Macomb County Jail.
Okay, so there's nothing wrong with that. That was just the judge reading off the law for certain offenses and the associated penalties. But I did see several instances where the court didn't seem to be fully complying with this new court rule. One example is a guy who came there shackled and in a jumpsuit. He'd already been in the Macomb County Jail for 11 days. He did not look physically healthy at all. And in fact, his family said he has severe mental health issues and that the prosecution was recommending treatment. He pleaded guilty to violating probation, and this was all over not paying some fees over a slew of misdemeanor charges. Here is his probation officer talking to the judge. She says that the probation office had never seen him at all, and they don't think he's ever going to comply with probation.
He's been incarcerated 11 days, so I'd recommend credit for those 11 days served. $820 is what he owes on our file right now. I'd recommend that be paid or serve additional time and just close out the file.
So the judge did end up waiving this man's fines, but he did get a 45-day jail sentence along with credit for the time he'd already served, and there was no formal hearing about his ability to pay. Another very similar case that same day, another man already in jail who had racked up lots of fines and fees over misdemeanor charges. His court-appointed lawyer even said this to the judge.
Well, it's a financial issue at this point, Judge. He's in and out of the hospital. I just don't see that he's going to have any ability to make money and pay.
In the end, the judge closed almost his cases and cleared the fines, too, but he did get a 30-day jail sentence, and there was no ability to pay inquiry.
So did you talk to any of the judges about this?
Well, this was in Judge Catherine Steenland's courtroom that I was in. She could not be reached this week, but I did talk to someone with the office of Chief Judge Marco Santillo with the 39th District Court. That office said they're definitely aware of the new pay-to-stay court rules. They got that memo, but each judge who's elected runs their own courtroom, and he couldn't comment on reports of what happens in other courtrooms.
I understand Macomb County paid someone to look at all of this recently. What did they find?
There was a big study done on the jail. It was commissioned in 2014, and it finally came out this year. And the big reason goes back to overcrowding. They were looking at why the jail's overcrowded, what can we do about it. This one took a really deep dive into the county's whole criminal justice system, obviously including the courts. And it found that basically Macomb County is putting too many people in jail for misdemeanors. There are too many people who are should be considered low-risk offenders who are in there, and that the courts in Macomb County have relied too much on fines and fees to fund themselves, and also that judges are setting what, quote, extremely high average bail bonds. And it suggests, easier said than done, get money out of the county's criminal justice system.
Hmm. Do we have any information about who's actually in the jail at any given time in Macomb County?
We do have some. It was a little hard to come by, but basically we know that about 40% of people in the jail at any given time in recent years, it seems, 40% are there for felonies, and the rest are there for some combination of misdemeanors and what are called public order offenses, which is usually alcohol-related. So that is significantly fewer people in for felonies than the national average.
Okay, big question. Will we see any real systemic change here now?
We might, to some extent. Anthony Wickersham is the sheriff in Macomb County, and he says that the county is moving forward with at least a couple of the big recommendations from the study. And one of them is a new central intake and booking facility. And the idea behind that is that it can allow them to assess defendants based on their risk to the public, which when you think about it is really who should be in jail. And when they're first arraigned, and therefore you can keep lower risk people out, divert them out of jail and keep the higher risk people in. Another potential thing that would be a really big change if they acted on it would be actually getting rid of cash bond, which is where the judge, when you first arraign and come before the judge says you basically need to pay this amount of money to get out of jail. The study recommends this. There's actually some national traction on this. In a way, it's similar to pay or stay. You go home if you can afford to pay bond. And Sheriff Wickersham says he could actually support getting rid of bond altogether.
Data does show it's safe. It's the communities, the individuals are supervised. So yeah, I would be in favor of something like that. But again, something I don't have control over.
And that's a point that he made again and again, which is that there are a variety of people involved in the criminal justice system making these decisions. So at the end of the day, we'll see how on board they are.
That is Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick, who's been investigating the Macomb County Jail. Thanks for coming in and telling us about this.
Thank you so much.
Let's take a moment to talk about tax incentives to lure a business. Wisconsin recently offered up to $3 billion in tax incentives to Foxconn of Taiwan. In Detroit, there have been hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives for the new arena for the Red Wings and Pistons, for developments by Dan Gilbert, huge tax credit for the auto manufacturers. And now states and cities are trying to put together incentives to get Amazon's new massive headquarters number two. The question always boils down to, will citizens actually benefit from their tax dollars being spent or forfeited to attract or retain business? Joining us now are our Friday political commentators, Vicki Barnett, former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Vicki, we're told that to be competitive, governments have to offer these incentives. But should there be limits?
This has always been a debate. You know, how much of tax dollars should go to private companies to lure development? And how does that impact our budgets going forward, whether it's the state budget, county budget, or local community budgets? The real other problem that we don't talk about is the impact of all of these tax incentives on the school aid fund, which impacts every child across the state of Michigan. So it's always been a balancing act to whether we can capture enough money through the growth by having these companies here versus the offset of actually providing the incentives. We did away with all incentives when Governor Snyder first took office in 2011 and tried to revamp the tax code, and it became clear over the ensuing few years that companies want hard dollar cash incentives. I'm not a real big fan of them, but the reality is that if you're going to be in a competitive market against 50 other states plus a global economy, you're going to have to provide something. And the goal is always to provide some incentives, but have the tax net be positive for the state of Michigan or for the local community.
Ken, policy analysts from the right and the left have been critical of Michigan and local governments for what they call corporate welfare. Generally, Republicans say they don't like picking winners and losers. Let the free market decide. But in practice, these incentives are doled out pretty liberally. How do policymakers or legislators make these decisions?
Well, Vicki said it. There's just kind of a fundamental reality going on here in the economy among all the states. They all have these packages. They all want these really big enterprises, whether it's Amazon, Foxconn, or Switch in Grand Rapids, which is a data processing center. And in Michigan and the other states can't unilaterally disarm. There's just a fundamental reality that drives these tax incentives. Now, there's kind of a small band of true believers, primarily among Republicans, that believe these packages are inappropriate for government because they violate principles of a competitive free market economy in which government basically has no role other than just keep hands off. But that's just, like I said, kind of a small band of true believers. And the fundamental reality is every state has to have these in order to attract these big, big job producers of thousands of jobs.
Let me ask both of you, when I started in this business back in the 80s, they were just beginning to start this and this incentives type packages at the municipal level, and it seems like it's escalated ever since. Am I right in that?
Yes, you are. The original tax abatement law, they were called 198 tax abatements in reference to the number of the law. And they were originally designed to provide tax incentives to businesses who moved back into areas where there was already infrastructure in the ground to redevelop property instead of expanding into exurban and massively suburban areas to build in what we call greenfields, where there's nothing there yet. And it was designed to kind of do both a cleanup of old property and to provide incentives for businesses to go where we already had high unemployment. That ended up being perverted over the years to have municipalities and others, counties as well, offer tax abatements in further and further ex-urban areas because that's the way that we created the tax structure for revenue sharing. And in order to get more money into your community and in order for your municipal budget to grow, you had to have new development, and that was part of the caps on Proposal A and a few other things. So it's created this kind of Frankenstein's monster of an incentive package that is now almost required by governments in order to lure these businesses into your state.
Ken?
Well, yes, Lester, they have escalated because every time Michigan or some other state comes up with an attractive package, some other state comes up with a more attractive package. And so they have escalated over time. Now, I do think, given the fact that there's a fundamental reality working here, you have to have them. It is helpful for policymakers to truly look at what the economic impact is and is it worth it. And then secondly, there has to be some accountability for these companies. If they claim and promise a certain number of jobs, they have to be held to that. And there's kind of a third big question about, well, when you locate these big enterprises, does it hurt or drive out some smaller local companies that have been there for some time that do the same thing? That's a fair question to ask, too. So there are some questions that have to be answered, but the reality is you're just going to have these packages.
Just real quick, is there a way that we can ever cap these or guarantee that taxpayers get the benefit back in a real and concrete way?
Well, I think you've got to look at the true economic impact, and economists will look at what is called the multiplier effect. You know, how many times money spent, in this case probably wages, circulates throughout the local economy. And it's got to be positive. If it's not positive, then why do it? But there are these questions of accountability and the impact on smaller companies that have been there for some time. But yeah, you've got to look at the economic impact and do a true analysis, and it has to be a net positive, as Vicki said early on.
Something that I'd like to see as part of these is the inclusion of what is called a community benefits agreement. And that's something that some former legislators and city council members in Detroit and in other areas have been talking about for a long time. If you're going to offer up community tax dollars to lure a business, what should that business bring back to the community in exchange for those dollars aside for jobs? And I think that's an important discussion to have as well.
That's Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
If you miss any part of today's show, and I can't imagine how you'd be pulled away from it, but if you do miss it, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts to find a link. Still to come, if weather doesn't equal climate, what are we to make of these intense hurricanes? We'll talk with climate change activist Bill McKibben. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. There was a time in the U.S. that we were considered an agricultural nation. These days, most people are a generation or two or three off the farm. Fewer than 2% of Americans live on farms, and often Americans don't understand where their food comes from, how it's grown, or how it's processed. A new effort at Michigan State University is trying to change that. The College of Agriculture and Natural Resources is leading an initiative called Food at MSU. Cheryl Kirschenbaum is a fellow with Food at MSU and joins us now. You were co-author of a recent article in The Conversation titled "Americans Are Confused About Food and Unsure Where to Turn for Answers," survey shows. That runs counter to what people say. So tell me about that survey. How large, how representative was the sample?
Well, we were interested to figure out what Americans know about food because we're absolutely a nation of foodies and we're taking pictures of our food and we're excited to share recipes on social media. But when it comes to answers about everything from sustainability to health and nutrition, it's not clear who the experts are or what the best science is. And so we ran this nationally representative survey based on U.S. Census demographics. We surveyed over 1,000 Americans. And what we found was that there's a lot of misinformation and probably pseudoscience out there. And hopefully there's a lot we can do to fill that void, that gap.
Give me a couple of examples about misperceptions about food.
Sure. Well, one of the things that really surprised us had to do with genetically modified foods. We asked respondents to say true or false to whether or not non-GMO foods had genes in them. And 37% of Americans thought that non-GMO foods did not have genes in them. And that just is an example of kind of a science literacy challenge, right? Because we have these conversations at this high level, maybe policy level, about labeling. And when you figure out what people even understand about what a GMO is and how it might impact their lives or their health or their family, there seems to be a real lack of understanding.
And just for the record, we have genes, cows have genes, green beans have genes, all the plants
have genes.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about genetically modified crops. The Europeans often call them frankenfoods. Generally speaking, U.S. consumers are suspicious of GMO foods and will avoid them if they are aware of them. What do people know about GMO?
It's a very complex topic, and unfortunately, with complexity comes a lot of nuance, and it's extremely difficult to boil down to a few talking points. So on GMOs, you have everyone from consumer groups to the science community at universities, government scientists, to kind of special interest-driven messaging that's hopping up on our Facebook feeds and our Instagram. And they're all telling us different information about what it means. We've been using different forms of transgenic crops, as we'll call them, for a very long time. But the technology is changing very quickly. And as a result, there's kind of this lag in public understanding of what a GMO actually means.
And recently, more and more scientists have been saying it's perfectly safe. However, some of these GMO crops have environmental impacts. In fact, all farming has some kind of environmental impact. What do people know about that?
Exactly. I mean, that's a big part of the challenge, right? Because there's not one catch-all basket for what a GMO is, who's producing it, how it's used. So you have products like golden rice. A lot of people, when they think about genetically modified foods, they think, oh, okay, pesticide resistance, Roundup Ready crops. GMOs can also do things like provide nutrition in certain foods in places, especially in developing world, where children, you know, aren't getting access to certain vitamins and minerals that they need to be able to see and to be healthy and survive. GMOs can also be, aside from being fortified to make vitamins and other things, they can also be drought resistant or flood resistant. I mean, we're absolutely going to be experiencing more floods and droughts in a changing planet due to climate change. So there's many ways that GMOs can help us become more resilient to the challenges that we face.
Well, there's this idea that farmers and science and technology will make up for any food security challenges, such as a rapidly growing global population or climate change. How realistic is it that the science and technology will outpace food shortages?
Well, again, it's a complex question. So, you know, famines exist now, but that's been largely due to distributional shortcomings, thanks to the Green Revolution, but that's only going to carry us so far. So as we see the global population climb to 9 billion in 2050 and more, it won't be a distributional challenge anymore. It'll more be, can we produce enough food in the face of less land for agriculture, less water? And GMOs are certainly part of that solution. I think that there's a lot of things that we can do to prepare, and transgenic crops, transgenic agriculture, as we call it, is already really a big part of that. Right now, we just don't always recognize that it's already taking place.
You intend to conduct this survey annually. What's the goal of that?
Michigan State University's Food Literacy and Engagement Index is meant to be a kind of baseline for where public understanding and attitudes are related to food. So while we ask about, you know, knowledge about GMOs, we also ask about people's general food access or their preference for organic foods, whether or not they'd be willing to spend a little more money if something could help the environment. So we ask a number of questions, and then we can break down all the data by demographic. We see differences between men and women, differences between different age groups. And ideally, if we continue this survey every year, we'll be able to track how and whether attitudes are changing. I mean, I don't expect we'll see a market shift by the time we do this next year, but possibly over time, we'll get a sense of whether, you know, GMOs are being more widely accepted in their adoption, if understanding about terms like organic may be changing. And it also, with regard to what we're doing here at Michigan State, because this is part of a new initiative called Food at MSU, we really want to have a broader conversation about food. So what we're learning from the survey is going to guide these roundtable discussions that we'll be having in communities across Michigan and ideally beyond Michigan in a few years about a wide range of food topics.
Cheryl Kirschenbaum is with Food at MSU, and along with Douglas Bueller, she is the co-author of an article in The Conversation titled Americans Are Confused About Food and Unsure Where to Turn for Answers. You can find it at theconversation.com. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Despite consensus among most scientists that climate change is real and humans are contributing through burning fossil fuels, there's still resistance to actually doing something about it. Oil, gas, and coal companies are fighting it. Businesses that heavily rely on fossil fuels are fighting it. And the politicians who are more worried about the economic cost today than they are the coming larger threats to the economy and life are fighting it. In 1989, a guy named Bill McKibben wrote the book End of Nature. It was the first book on climate change intended for a general audience. McKibben was the annual Wege lecturer last night at the University of Michigan, and we talked to him backstage.
For nearly three decades, you've been telling people we need to dramatically reduce the burning of fossil fuels that cause greenhouse gases. And I'm wondering what kind of progress has been made since you started talking about it in 1989.
So the answer is nowhere near enough. This is a race against the physics of climate change. We've put so much carbon into the atmosphere that we're now seeing wholesale damage. The rapid melt of the ice caps at either end of the Earth, the destruction of coral reefs, changes, huge changes in the drought and flood cycles around this planet. And though we've begun to deploy solar energy and wind energy and things, we're nowhere near doing it on the scale that we could or the scale that we need to.
I want to ask you about some of the storms this summer. When climate change deniers point to a snowstorm or colder than average weather, they present it as proof that climate change is a hoax. Mm-hmm. Lately, people have been pointing at the hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Maria, and possibly Nate hitting the U.S. as well, as proof that climate change is happening. But isn't that falling into the same trap? What's weather? What's climate?
So I think the way to look at it is, are we seeing things that the climate scientists told us would be happening? And we are. We're seeing dramatic increases in all the kinds of phenomenon that we'd been told to expect. Big heat waves, big droughts, big floods, all the sort of things that happen as you raise the temperature, as you allow warm air to hold more water vapor than cold. That's what we're seeing time and again. And the numbers are just speak for themselves. I mean, each of the last 3 years has now set a record for the hottest temperature we've ever seen on this planet.
Are these hurricanes more intense because of warmer water?
So hurricanes draw their power from the heat in the upper layers of the planet. We've set the records for highest wind speeds ever recorded in hurricanes, set and broken them again and again over the last 4 or 5 years. September of this year, which was, you know, Harvey, Irma, Maria, was the month with the most hurricane activity, what the scientists call accumulated cyclonic energy, in the Atlantic of any month measured since we started keeping records in 1851.
President Donald Trump is among those who've said climate change is a hoax. He called the Paris Climate Accord a bad deal for the U.S. and he plans to pull out of the agreement in 2020. You wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. What was the title of that piece?
I believe it was Trump's stupid and reckless climate decision.
Okay, so why do you feel it's stupid and reckless?
Well, in the first place, I mean, what the president has said is that climate change is a hoax manufactured by the Chinese. If you were sitting on a public bus and the guy next to you was muttering that climate change was a hoax manufactured by the Chinese, you'd probably get up and find another seat, okay? This guy doesn't seem to know much about a lot of things, but he clearly knows nothing about climate change. And the decision to pull out of the Paris Agreement was a particularly, well, let me say this. I think of myself as a patriotic soul. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts. The American Revolution began. My summer job for years was to put on a tricorn hat and go give tours of the Battle Green. And so I inclined toward a kind of sentimental patriotism and used to thinking of the United States as a country that helps solve the world's problems, that we would be the only country to renege on our promises in Paris, to pull out of the deal, the bargain that we'd made with the rest of the planet. That should be a source of shame for Americans.
Tell me what you think of the job that EPA Administrator Pruitt is doing.
I think he's doing a tremendous job for the people who put him there, which were basically the Koch brothers and the oil industry. He's doing absolutely everything that they could ever have hoped to have accomplished. They're dismantling 30, 40, 50 years of environmental improvement, and they're doing it in record order. So if that's what you want out of the Secretary of EPA, you couldn't ask for a guy doing a better job.
While the current administration is dismantling all the government's attempts to reduce greenhouse gases, gas emissions, car manufacturers and power companies, retailers like Walmart and developers, they're all making changes on their own. They're all becoming more energy efficient. They're talking about electric cars and the end of the combustion engine. At what point is the government's position on climate change irrelevant?
I'm afraid never. And the reason is because if we're going to make this change in time to make a difference, we're going to have to go faster than is economically convenient. We're going to have to go faster than we want to go. And so government's going to have to push us along, government being us. We're going to have to make the joint decision that we want to do this fast enough to catch up with the physics of climate change. Otherwise, 60, 70, 80 years from now, we'll have lots of solar panels and lots of windmills, but they'll be presiding over a busted planet.
You founded the group 350.org. It's a worldwide group. The name indicated we should work to keep the CO2 levels from rising above 300 parts per million. This summer, we've been fairly consistently above 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. What does that tell you?
It tells me we're in deep and literal hot water. 350 is probably the most important number in the world. It sort of delineates the zone of safety for the planet, the zone where we can have anything like the world that we've known since human history began. Okay? We're now out of that zone and out of it by a long ways. And so the effects that we've already seen and the effects that are coming in the momentum that we've built up, very, very frightening.
for those people who understand the science of climate change, believe that something should be done, it's really frustrating because they feel like there's not enough they can do in their life. What do you recommend? What can people do?
So it's great to do things at your home and your light bulbs and your car and your solar panels, but and I've done all those things and I'm happy I did, but that's not how we're going to solve this problem at this point. Mathematically, we're going to have to work together to change policy that allows big, rapid, society-wide change. That means the most important thing an individual can do is not be quite so much an individual. Join together in groups like 350.org or some other to force that kind of political change that gives us some hope of action that's on a scale that's the same size as the crisis we face.
You mentioned some hope. What gives you hope?
Two things give me hope. One is the great work of the engineers. They've dropped the price of a solar panel 80% in the last decade, and they're not done yet, so that's a good sign. Second thing is the big rise of movements around the planet. All of a sudden, there's enough people in the way that the fossil fuel industry is having a hard time building new pipelines, fracking new wells, digging new coal mines. If we can keep that pressure on, then we give those engineers enough time to fill in the void.
You gave the Wege lecture at the University of Michigan. You mentioned Line 5, Enbridge's Line 5, which goes under the Straits of Mackinac. What is your concern about Line 5?
Well, there's two things. One, the most obvious is the Great Lakes are one of the most precious resources in the world. You're telling me there's a pipeline sitting on the bottom of the Great Lakes that's been there for 60 years just so we can make a little shortcut for oil coming from Canada to get back into Ontario, that it's worth risking the biggest supply of fresh water on the planet for that? It doesn't seem like a good cost-benefit analysis to me. Second thing is, even if it doesn't spill, when it gets to the other end and it gets burned in somebody's gas tank or wherever it ends up, then the carbon it puts in the atmosphere changes Michigan and the Great Lakes and every place around it powerfully. That's what's happening to our winters. That's what's driving our new storms. That's what's making life very, very different.
Bill McKibben, nice to talk to you again.
A great pleasure, Lester. Many thanks.
How does an elite group of nine people shape everything from marriage and money to safety and sex for an entire nation? Next week, Michigan Radio will air a special five-part series called More Perfect. It's an hour-long deep dive into the Supreme Court, produced and hosted by Radiolab's Jad Abumrad. We're going to bypass all the wonkiness and instead tell the story behind some of the court's most monumental decisions. That's More Perfect next week at 3 and 10 on Michigan Radio. Stateside will return to its regular time slots on Monday, October 16th. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Have some fun this weekend.